Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Yeah, you can laugh. I'm the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
So many great stories from the weekend's Premier League football. Shock defeats for Spurs and Manchester United. Liverpool continue their 100% start to the season. Frank Lampard's first competitive win as Chelsea manager. But there's only one place to start today's Second Captain's Football Podcast. Another El Mago Masterclass. And this on the occasion of his 400th appearance for Manchester City. David Silva, we salute you. All of us here at Second Captain's salute you. Isn't that right, Murph and Ken?
Hello, Owen.
How are you going?
I hope you have a good show today.
How are you doing there, Owen?
We're doing silent treatment on this. Is that how you're dealing with it from now on?
Well, if there was ever game that I...
August against Bournemouth.
Game that I would have expected a big David Silva performance.
Could be worse, Ken. I could be starting with the David Luiz shit show. But more on that anon, I'm sure.
Well, bring it on.
Scourge of Bournemouth, David Silva.
Yeah.
He knitted the move together for Sergio Aguero's opener. Created his 115th Manchester City assist. We don't create an assist, but you know what I'm saying. Achieved his 115th Man City assist for Raheem Sterling's goal before dribbling into the box for Aguero's second, City's third, leaving Graeme Souness open-mouthed in admiration in the Sky Sports studio.
It's an argument for him being the best Premier League player ever, what he's won. Mm. On a personal level, I mean, he's just got the most wonderful football brain. He's not the biggest. He plays in the most difficult area, which is just, second most difficult. Just behind the striker, receives the ball in tight areas, and he's got a picture in his head long before he receives the ball. He's not a midfield player. He has to go into the back four or the back three and get the easy pass. He plays in a really difficult place, and he's been the best around at that in our league for a long, long time.
Yeah, well said, Souness. I mean, exactly the same thing you said a few months ago, which is what kick-started this whole thing.
Was it him?
Yeah, Souness. Rory Smith had written a gushing piece around the same time. Souness added the TV oomph to that movement and a few other people. Not the biggest, you hear Graeme Souness say, right? But did you know, guys? I didn't know until Jolyon Lescott, who was sitting beside Graeme Souness, told me about it yesterday. Told the Sky Sports viewers. Bet you guys didn't know that David Silva may not be the biggest, but an absolute beast in the gym.
Plays a high number of games. He works extremely hard in the gym.
Yeah.
Look, I did know that David Silva is a good athlete, yes.
Hold on, Ken. There's one more. Got a Pep Guardiola clip. A lot of headlines around that Pep said Silva is the best he's ever worked with, which he didn't quite say. In fact, he seemed a little bit reluctant to get in on this whole praise fest. He was in strange L form post-match.
400th appearance for David Silva for City today. I mean, what more can you say about him that you haven't said already? I mean, there aren't many better players, are there, really?
Yeah, in smaller spaces, a competitor, he plays incredible well. So David, in this kind of games, like the opponent defence so deep and few spaces, is so good.
You've managed and worked with many of the best players in the last couple of decades. Of course, everybody knows that. Presumably, you put him in that very top bracket of all of the people that you've worked with.
He's one of the best, yeah. Yeah, he's one of the best players I ever trained or I ever seen. Yeah.
Presumably you put him in that top bracket among the best players you've ever worked with. Give me a line here, Pep. I know you're in bad form, but I've been asked to ask about David Silva and you have to say something great. Yes, he's one of the best. Yes.
He is the big man for the little occasion, Owen. Manchester City, of course, have a record of, well, 9 wins out of 9 against Bournemouth, which is the best 100% record of any team against any team in the history of the top English division. So if there was one game that I felt was a banker for a big David Silva performance, yeah, it would be Manchester City away to Bournemouth or at home to Bournemouth.
Because obviously if you lose those games or drop points in those games, that doesn't affect the league.
Of course, that never happens when Manchester City play Bournemouth, as we know.
So patient, keep creating overloads all over the pitch.
I mean, it is very difficult to stop David Silva when he, you know, gets in between the lines and starts dictating the play with those little balls. I mean, the move for the first goal was brilliant. The move for the ball for Sterling for the second goal was absolutely brilliant. He led the charge for the third goal, himself and Aguero just running into the box together. I believe he is peerless in those types of situations. I do feel, however, the best Premier League player ever wouldn't be a guy who simply goes missing in a lot of big matches. Do we have Iggy Pop? I don't know if Son has Iggy Pop at his fingertips. But, you know, it's not so much the games where David Silva is very obviously running the game that I would question, as the games when he can't be detected on the pitch. What's going on out there?
We'll keep an eye out, Ken. There'll be those games for the rest of the season. Don't worry, it's David Silva's valedictory tour this year. So there'll be lots more analysis, I'm sure, on the podcast. That's 400 up for him now. And congratulations again. Thank you also.
The 40th best midfielder forward that's ever played in the Premier League, as I've already crowned him. So congratulations again to
Mr. Brightside, to Jamil Aboubakar, and to Colin Duffy, amongst others, for telling me all about that David Silva coverage over the last couple of days. Big week on the World Service coming up. All-Ireland football build-up right through the week, starting tomorrow as Richie Sadler puts Mayo's Andy Moran in the player's chair, looks into that big old football brain of his, and sees what he can find. We're going to talk Newcastle later with Mark Douglas, football editor of Chronicle Live, after Steve Bruce stuck it to his many critics yesterday. First up, of course, is the Report on Sport.
The stuff he's won. Like, he's won 4 league titles playing for Man City in 10 years. Like, Phil Neville won more league titles than that. And more Champions Leagues. Not as many World Cups, admittedly, but I can't remember David Silva having a huge role to play in that particular World Cup. I mean,
he played one game and then got dropped.
To be fair, Pepe Reina also has a World Cup winner's medal, you know, and I don't know if... Look, we don't need to keep talking about that. I mean, why don't we talk about somebody else? Okay, we'll talk about the game that happened at Anfield at 5:30 on Saturday evening. Owen, do you have any questions for me about this game?
What did you make of David Luiz's performance, Ken?
Well, I thought he's already improved Arsenal massively.
From 5-1 to 3-1.
It's a big improvement. Nobody said, not even I was arguing, that he was going to be able to solve these problems.
I mean, that's a 40% improvement there, straight off the bat.
This is a...
He's only getting started, Ken. That's the scary thing for the rest of the league.
This is a player who has joined a team in their last... Do you remember the statistic? 23 away matches against the other big six, up to report. Arsenal have 0 wins, 8 draws, 15 losses, 53 goals conceded, 1 clean sheet. So what I'm saying is that Arsenal have been a mess in these games for a long time, and you don't have to go back very far. I mean, you can go back to last season to find a much worse match for Arsenal at Anfield, where they were hammered 5-1, and it could have been more. And you don't have to go back very far before then. 4-0 the previous season, where they're absolutely hammered again, ripped to pieces, and it could have been more. So in the circumstances, 3-1...
It's actually a 50% improvement. I've been doing the math. Like 5-1 becomes 3-1.
3-1 is pretty good.
You're having the deficit.
Ken, I might take your rather spurious logic at some sort of face value if David Luiz had been in the middle of this defence while everything else was falling apart around him, if he'd been marshalling the troops and had been a rock at the centre, making no mistakes and trying to lead them through the darkness. But no, he was at the centre of it. He was giving away penalties. He was not fouling when he should have tried to foul. When Salah burst clear later on.
Well, brilliant strategic brain here from Owen. You would have, if you'd been David Luiz, you would have fouled Mohamed Salah for that third goal and been sent off.
It would have made more sense to commit a foul on that one than the one inside the box where a penalty is given away.
The one inside the box. Well, actually, David Luiz gave a sort of curious justification for that, which is that he essentially, his justification was, I thought I'd get away with it. And actually, I spoke to Momo. He calls Mo Salah Momo. They are former teammates, I guess, from Chelsea. I spoke to Momo and he said, I never felt it. Mm-hmm. He didn't realise that he had been yanked back by the shirt. Then he blamed the shirts and he said, oh, you know, basically the game's gone. People can just wear extra long shirts, extra large shirts now, and it looks really bad. But all I was doing was just taking a little bit of the power off that move. And, you know, unfortunately, the referee just made that decision. You know, what could I do? So he got booked. Then the second one, he couldn't really do much about it. I mean, it was a very interesting game in terms of the way Arsenal approached it. I was a bit surprised. And Jurgen Klopp was saying afterwards, oh, we were really surprised. You know, we looked at 8 matches. They never played this way.
He seemed pleasantly surprised, Jurgen Klopp, that there was a diamond.
Well, it was. I mean, Emery obviously decided we can't really compete with these guys. We can't play a real game against them. So we're going to have to try and be a little bit clever. I mean, he had said that thing before the game, or after Arsenal's last game. Oh, we never want to play Liverpool. This came up with Klopp. Can we hear a bit of Klopp? This is how Klopp responded to that before the game. You know, when Emery says Arsenal never want to play you guys. And Klopp was saying, well, you know, obviously he was joking. But then he started talking about what he does want to hear opponents saying.
We want to be the team nobody wants to play against. But I still have to. It's not about being before that you don't want to play against us because we need opponents. It's that in the game you think, whoa. That's too much. They are too intense. They are too quick, too strong, too fast. Whatever. Too greedy, too angry, whatever.
Imagine the Arsenal players standing around. Whoa, that is too much. They are too intense.
It's the most Arnie Schwarzenegger he's ever sounded.
Whatever. Too angry, too greedy. So that was him trying to hype them up, you know, beforehand. And the way that it started, that was pretty much how it started. But it became clear that Arsenal were going to try and really play 8 men back and 2 up front. You know, this was the plan. It was, let's defend really deep. Let's just try and block the goal and hope that our 2 guys up front, Pepe and Aubameyang, will be able to score on the counterattack. And this nearly worked. You know, this Pepe, after a few minutes, dribbled past Van Dijk. This was the moment everyone had been waiting for. He dribbled past him and then Van Dijk got back and blocked him for the second attempt to dribble past him. Aubameyang had a chance when Adrian came out. There was confusion between him and Van Dijk. Aubameyang could have scored that one where he lobbed it just wide. Then there was a chance for Pepe where he was kind of free on the outside the box. Walked past Andy Robertson and very nearly scored with a shot to the top corner. Then, a couple of minutes after that, Henderson gave it away. And again, Pepe breaking, again, destroyed Andy Robertson. And really should have scored this one. It was a one-on-one. So there, you've got one really good chance, 2 decent chances, and Pepe looking incredibly dangerous to the extent that I thought it was beginning to kind of unsettle the Liverpool defenders a little bit. It was like, this guy can actually just dribble past us. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this doesn't usually happen. But at the other end, these were just the little outbreaks for a game that was almost all happening just in Arsenal's third. And part of it was because Arsenal, for some reason, just had this insistence on playing out from the back in the most methodical way, like as though there was some kind of a rugby rule where you could only pass it sideways. You can't pass the ball forwards. And it was like they were kind of beginning on their own goal line and trying to move up methodically from there. And you're thinking, what? Whose idea was this? This is insanity. This is absolute insanity. You can see there's a logic in the sense they're going to push right up to try and get the ball off us. And that means there's going to be more space behind for our guys, Aubameyang and Pepe. But the problem was they could never really make that pass. You know, the most dangerous pass that put one of them through was actually Henderson's miss kick when he lost out. And that was the one where Pepe sort of got through one-on-one. But they couldn't work an angle to make a pass from the back that far up the pitch. And I mean, the only chance Liverpool ended up having in that first half was when Ceballos crossed it to Mane, because he was penned in by three Liverpool players beside his own corner flag from a goal kick. Mm. Now, that was just... I don't understand why they're doing this. It would have seemed... And they'd obviously left Lacazette on the bench, who I think had played really well the last couple of games.
But what's the option aside from just hoofing it long?
To try to... To try to take the game to Liverpool a little bit more. To try... I mean... Emery took the view before the game, my team can't compete with theirs. So the only way we can do it is by really disciplined defending, not giving them a sight of goal, and hoping we get the look. We get the look either on the break or they don't score. And it was actually going pretty well because they had the best chance in the first half. Liverpool didn't make a single clear chance apart from the one that was presented to Mane, much to his surprise. And then Arsenal let in a set piece. And that's always going to be the weak link in this, because, you know, that's a kind of a toss of a coin. Not really. I mean, it's usually in the defense's it's a coin toss in the defense's favor, but there's not much you can do about it if the ball is right and they've got a tall player who gets his head on it. You can't really legislate for that.
Especially when you're worried about one of the other tall guys and you're pulling and dragging him.
Well, yeah, it was quite funny. You could see everybody jumping on Van Dijk, and him, he was turning to scream at the referee as Matip was still heading towards the ball to head it. But I thought, imagine being Joe Matip. Like, you know, you score a goal, you pull out a move in the second half where you play Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang offside. It's not picked up. You then run back, chase down the offside Aubameyang and block his shot on goal, which was an absolutely phenomenal piece of defending. And all everybody talks about afterwards is Virgil van Dijk. It's just Virgil van Dijk was dribbled past today, but, you know, he still really gave a magisterial performance against the dangerous Pepe. And I'm kind of like, this guy, Matip, just, it's difficult for him. Hopefully he's not a guy who needs a lot of credit from the outside world, because he's certainly not going to get it. But, you know, Arsenal, once they'd let in that goal, then it was interesting to see, what are they going to do? And what they did was stuck with what they were doing, hoping that, right, I thought it was a bit, it wasn't really ambitious from Emery. It was realistic. I think from the point of view of Arsenal fans, some Arsenal fans would be like, no, this is a bit too cowardly. We're not this kind of team that just can, all we can hope for is a goal on the break. But they tried to keep playing the same way. Now, in France, Liverpool actually played better after half time. But Arsenal tried to keep playing the same way with the deep defence and two guys up front, hoping maybe they'd get an equaliser this way. And instead, they ended up letting in the second goal. David Luiz gave away the penalty, but it's actually a really good move. You know what I mean? He gives away the penalty. It's going to be a goal if he doesn't commit a foul. You know, you're criticising him for not committing a foul on the third one because it's going to be a goal. I mean, he'd already done that.
I don't know. I mean, the argument that some of the analysts were making was that if he'd positioned himself better and been more disciplined in his defending, he wouldn't have been in a position where he felt he had to tug Salah back. Or even maybe he didn't have to do it. There was still a chance to recover, potentially. But it was just kind of a lazy, oh, Salah, I couldn't be hard. I'll just pull him, you know.
It's not
great defending.
Well, you mean for the second goal?
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't say it was great defending either, but I do think it was a great piece of play by Firmino. Mm-hmm. Like, the ball is absolutely hammered in at him, and with his first touch... With one touch with his bad foot, he just stuns it for Salah. So Salah can run onto this. It's not going to go over the end line. It's fallen for him pretty perfectly, unless he gets pulled back, which he does. Salah then scored the penalty. And then Arsenal are like, okay, we're 2-0 down. We now have to change our approach and push right up to halfway. And that's when they let in the third goal. So the third goal is brilliant play by Salah. Not just for the way that he beats Luiz and then gets away from Monreal, but the way that he gets the ball from Fabinho. Watch that. That's what makes the goal. He is kind of in the middle of the pitch. Fabinho gets the ball. It's not really a pass that anyone's thinking about. You know what I mean? It sort of doesn't look like there's much on there.
Yeah.
But Fabinho makes a great pass. But Salah essentially runs across David Luiz from a central position out wide and then gets it, tents him in with a little touch, and then goes around the outside of him. And it was brilliant. Okay, Luiz will always foul him there if he hasn't already got a yellow card. He feels he can't do that. And so he's given away two goals. But, you know, I think Salah has got the better of a lot of defenders. I don't think it necessarily means it's all over. You know, this whole thing, like, it was saying, Arsenal will win nothing with this back four. And they probably won't. Arsenal will probably not win much with these players in general. But David Luiz has won trophies everywhere he's played. He's won trophies at Benfica, Chelsea the first time around, PSG, Chelsea the second time around. He's won major trophies.
Improving the Arsenal back four is a pretty low bar of expectation for a guy who's won, as you say, as much as he has in his career, though. I mean, as you say, like, the Arsenal probably wouldn't win anything with that back four, but they definitely weren't going to win anything with last season's back four, which was a lot worse without David Luiz, I would humbly suggest.
Well, look, absolutely, Kieran, I'm glad that you're on board.
What?
Well, that's not what that sounded like to me.
Well, no, I'm saying he's a much better centre-half than Mustafi.
Yes. If Mustafi had played, what would it have been? 5-6. I thought he held them together pretty well. I mean, the game plan was...
He didn't hold them together pretty well.
Well, I don't know how closely you watched that first half, Owen, but it was, it was getting quite frustrating for Liverpool, I would suggest. With their failure to create good chances until they got that coin toss of the headed goal from the set piece, and suddenly the ebb and flow of psychic energy was against the Gunners. And obviously Arsenal then scored a goal because, I suppose Liverpool thought the game has been won here. And then... what else? Yeah, that's so they're top of the league, Liverpool, after three matches. They're 2 points clear. It's interesting how spread out the league is already. You know, Liverpool on 9, City on 7, Arsenal are still third on 6. And then fourth place is Leicester on 5, and fifth place Man United on 4. So it's kind of, already those teams, the two sort of favourites for the title are beginning to move away from the pack. City, we've mentioned. I actually didn't think their performance against Bournemouth was great. Yeah, I know it was a David Silva masterclass.
Raheem Sterling.
A hummingbird in the land of the Lilliputians.
Right, well.
Like an Apache helicopter.
If you think David Silva enjoys himself against Bournemouth,
have a
look at Raheem Sterling. He scores roughly a hat-trick a game against
him. Well, Sterling's the top scorer in the league, I think. 5 goals. He's in sensational form. Kevin De Bruyne's 50th assist, not his best one. Admittedly, it was a missed kick, which fell nicely for Aguero. Making him the fastest player to 50 assists, 123 games, ahead of Mesut Ozil, second, 141. Cantona, 143. Bergkamp, 146. Fabregas, 165. David Silva, 166.
My man.
David Beckham, 170. But I thought City were particularly a little bit lucky with a decision that Ederson got in his favour quite early in the match. Did you see that one where...
Remind me of that.
It was ball played down the left. Ederson ran out of his box, as is his custom. Didn't get there, wasn't going to get there, and took out his opponent with a waist-high challenge on the touchline. Now I thought to myself, really? That's a yellow card? It was a yellow card. I was a little... I thought, any other player does that sort of waist high? There's obviously the yellow card for this type of foul, a kind of a tactical foul, like a professional foul, except it's far enough away from the goal, you know what I mean? But there are also a few instances you could point to of when that tactical foul is just a little bit too violent. I mean, remember this happened to Wayne Rooney. Rooney got sent off playing for Manchester United for chopping someone down in the centre circle. Clearly, he just thought, oh, I've got to take that guy. I've got to take one for the team here. Chop the guy down. I can't remember which who the opponent was on that occasion, but was then astonished when the referee produced the straight red, because he's like, you can't boot someone that hard. You just can't.
I've got to take one for the team, but I'm also going to have a little nibble just for myself.
Yeah, you can't. So I thought, wow, Ederson has been quite lucky, but that was a decision that maybe could have... changed the game. He actually played pretty well. It didn't change the game. There was also, though, a strange one. And this was one of several examples of this that happened over the weekend, of David Silva being fouled by Jefferson Lerma and no penalty being given. So it was just like Silva runs into the box, goes down, and is obviously really angry. Just the intensity of his reaction of injustice is just, you're looking at it going...
But he's jacked up from all that gym work he's doing.
He is a beast. He's a beast in the gym.
What an absolute unit.
But he was,
you know, he used to out bench press Vincent Kompany.
Yeah,
when Kompany was there.
Yeah. Oh, listen, I believe it. I mean, I've heard dafter things said about David Silva. So.
Did you see Kompany has been relieved of his managerial
duties?
Well,
no, he's just repurposing himself.
Yeah.
I mean, he's about to unleash all of the awesome power of his playing ability.
Four matches as player manager, and now he's just player.
Yeah.
He's also apparently injured and may miss his own testimonial.
Should have picked manager.
But look,
sorry, so the penalty, yeah, no, that happened. There were a few of these where it looks like a fairly obvious one that you could overturn, no penalty awarded by the ref, but then VAR looks at it and says, nah, still no penalty, even though it seemed as though the defender had his literally stamped on Silva.
Well, it was a foul. Yeah. I thought it was a foul. I mean, it is, like, he's still on Silva's foot. So, and yet the referee, the VAR decides not to give it. So this was I thought a weird, I did not expect this, but there was loads of complaining by managers about penalties not given. And I thought this at least would be one thing that would be cut down on by VAR. Now, some managers have a different approach than others. Pochettino, for instance, at least so far, I mean, most of the VARs have been in his favour, although not yesterday, saying, look, I respect their decision. I'm not going to talk about it. But Solskjaer was just almost came in with a list of stuff. Well, you know, Martial should have been a red card, and then there was a penalty, and this wasn't given, that wasn't given, and a whole list of complaints. And you're kind of like, well, on one level, they've looked at all that stuff and they decided not based on the replay. So are you seriously going to keep doing this? You know, this is like the old school manager. You'd think this would be one thing that would be cleaned up about VAR, but it's not.
But did you not raise this point yourself a couple of weeks ago that this actually will make fans and potentially players and managers actually angrier, because not only are they not getting a decision now of all clubs, Manchester United feeling that they're being, you know, that they're getting a poor rub of the green from the establishment might make a lot of people laugh, but managers will think,
oh, you have been awarded two penalties in your three Premier League games.
Yeah,
so far,
exactly. So. Someone's got it in for me, you know. It's like, because they've looked at it, clearly that has to be changed, and they have looked at it and decided they aren't going to change it. So there is that dynamic to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they can't argue they missed this. They've looked at to my fevered brain, convincing evidence of a penalty, and they're just not seeing it. Yeah. You know, what gives here? Something is rotten within the state of Stockley or whatever. But there was a few of these. So in the Chelsea game, there was one. Azpilicueta was fouled. A small foul, but like, it was a foul. No penalty. There was the Martial one in the Manchester United game. And also the Gary Cahill not being sent off for, you know, could have easily been a red card. It was a yellow card. There was the Silva one. And there was the Harry Kane one.
Yeah.
I didn't think the Harry Kane one was a penalty, actually.
That's interesting, because Alan Shearer, Mr. VAR, was saying the same as you. And he said, oh, it's not clear and obvious. We've had a conversation behind the scenes, and five people in the conversation said it was, five said it wasn't. I thought it was the clearest penalty I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, really?
That Newcastle legend, yeah. Alan Shearer, didn't think that it wasn't a penalty.
No, but I think Shearer, more to the point, similar to how certain people have backed David Silva, certain have backed David Luiz, you get behind a certain horse and you have to stay with that horse at a finish line.
Are you saying that might colour someone's opinion?
I'm saying...
Owen, that's the skirt.
In this case...
You should retract that. Shearer, I think before we go on, we should... Owen, you should retract that too.
Shearer reckons that it wasn't clear and obvious. I thought it was, but clearly it wasn't. Like, by definition of this conversation we're having,
so
it wasn't
obvious.
Clear and obvious.
I thought it was.
He was starting to fall over and he's like, I'm going to take Kane
out.
Yeah,
partial credit for, like, trying to make it look like
you
fell over.
If we're the three VAR guys, I think there's only one person who actually makes a decision. If we're three parts of the brain of the guy making the decision in Stockley Park, who's making the big calls out in Stockley Park, that's what I ask. Yeah. Well then, you know, one third of that brain has a doubt about it. Therefore, they can't overturn it because it's not clear and obvious.
Oh, it has to be all three must agree?
All three parts of the brain of the one brain. I think it's only one person who makes a decision.
Well, no, but I mean, your brain is never 100% behind any idea, no matter how trivial it is in your life. If it's 66 2/3%, then the brain must...
Actually clear and obvious.
I just saw Harry Kane.
Sorry, that's just the brain.
I was just looking to see if I'd left my computer audio or something. I thought Harry Kane just leaned into it. He was trying to get it. Like, just go for the ball. Go for the ball. If you get fouled, you'll get a penalty. It'll all be on VAR. But anyway, so I did think that the logic of this system would be for everything increasingly to be given. Logic was maybe the wrong word to use about this. We'll see how it goes. But it almost seemed as though they were like, oh, you know, we're giving too much stuff.
Yeah, it's not exactly benefiting the attacking team. As like most changes that have been made to the rules of football in the last 30 years are to benefit the attacking team.
Yeah.
And this one...
There was the exception to it was the penalty that Wolves got against Burnley, which was like in the very last minute, like the fifth minute of injury time. And it was a really dubious one. Mm. Like it was a... Burnley guy is going to clear the ball, and essentially one of the Wolves players got his foot in front of that guy's foot, like stretching it around, and really, you know, yeah. Like what are you doing? Like, it's just he's trying to get kicked by your man, and they give this one where you know, okay. Anyway, we don't want to talk about that anymore. Man United against Palace was pretty amazing. Solskjaer before the match had said, "I'm not going to do it and change." Paul and Marcus are both still on them. And then Marcus obviously takes it this time, Marcus Rashford, and misses.
Did you say obviously, did you assume he was going to take it this time?
Well, Paul Pogba missed the last one, right?
Yeah. But so, the way this, I don't know what the
Well, in order for Paul Pogba to take this one, he'd have to push aside Marcus Rashford, who'd scored, even though he had missed in the last game, much to the annoyance of, I imagine, a majority of the crowd. And perhaps of Rashford. So you could have guessed that Rashford is going to take this one, I think. Laurie Whitwell, I see, had reported that, in fact, he was chosen before the game. But I'm not sure, because Solskjaer, before the game himself, said they're both still on them.
There have been stories during the week that he had picked Rashford and that he told Rashford and all this kind of stuff. But when he was asked in his press conference, he said, oh, no, they're both still on them. You had the same view as David Moyes, Ken.
Really?
One of the pundits in Premier Sports.
Me and Moyes, they both.
I asked him, who do you think
he's best mates with Ferguson? Yeah.
Who's going to take a penalty? And one word, Rashford.
Right.
Which was correct. It was great getting a penalty, I must say, just from the point of view of covering the game.
Oh, yes. What did Moyes think of the.
He thought it was the right decision for Rashford to take it.
Yeah. Perhaps the wrong decision for Rashford to kick the penalty at 200 miles an hour.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. No, he actually
you don't get an extra half goal.
Was
for
it himself or Richard
Dunn?
Certainly one of the pundits were saying that he was unlucky, but I don't know. Are you ever unlucky when you miss a penalty?
Yes.
Are you?
Yeah, you can be.
Well, I mean, when you hit the inside of the post and it goes
Goes
wide.
Out for a goal kick. I don't think I've ever seen that. Yeah, when was the last time I've seen that?
It's not unlucky.
No, but it's obviously, well struck with it. But the argument there is he had given him the eyes. The keeper had started to go the wrong way. So by the time he struck the ball, he actually didn't need to whip it, as Ken says, at 200 miles an hour. Yeah. And he didn't necessarily need to hit into the corner. That was one of those ones that you could just sort of roll gently just right of middle or left of middle.
Yeah, it's not one of those...
But Rashford does leather all his penalties, though.
Yeah, and I think
really
when you give the goalkeeper the eyes, that, you know, that doesn't actually affect how you strike the penalty. So you give the goalkeeper the eyes to try and convince the goalkeeper to go one way. But then as you strike the penalty, you're not...
You don't want to change your strike.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I get that.
I mean, it's still... I mean...
Does Rashford stay on the penalties, though?
Yeah, he does, yeah.
What if he misses a second one?
Well, when he catches up to Paul Pogba's miss ratio, then we can have a conversation. But until then, leave it to Marcus Rashford. I mean, I'm a Manchester United fan. I have to say, I laughed like a drain when he missed the penalty. Like, come on.
The
like,
story.
It's,
narrative,
it's
man.
Obviously...
Not about narrative.
One of the most hilarious things to have happened in the last 12 months of football.
And they could have had more. So I really wish it ended up with three penalties.
Yeah.
You know, just to see
when
who
you're
takes
watching
each
it,
one.
Like he puts the ball down on the ground. You're just like, for no reason, there's now an insane amount of pressure on this penalty over and beyond the actual match situation, which is already pressurized.
Completely,
yeah. And you're just like, this is so stupid. This is so ridiculous, so needless. All that this needs now is for Marcus Rashford to miss this penalty. And of course, he duly did.
Yes, he did. And it was okay, but Man United continued to fight back. I mean, the game was a strange one. Like, they had all the ball, as teams away to Palace or at home to Palace often do. The only shot I can remember from the first half was Daniel James had a chance, which was blocked by one of the Palace defenders. And they conceded a goal to Palace's first attack, which was a goalkeeper kick out. Now, what did you... I was having an argument, actually, with people over this. Whose fault was that?
I'm going to defer... I know what you're getting at here. I'm going to defer to legendary Ireland centre-half Richard Dunn on this.
Who said?
Harry Maguire.
Okay, what did he say, Harry Maguire?
Because he said that...
You've got to... As a centre-half, you've got to expect that your central defensive partner is going to crumple like a wet paper cup.
Well, his argument was that, yeah, that Lindelof's not incredible in the air. It's not. And also, there are two players converging on him. One that he has to compete with for the header, and a second who's looking for a knockdown. Mm-hmm. So what's the point of Harry Maguire standing 20 yards away doing nothing? So yeah, that is, you're kind of steering that point, but that's the point. It's like, what's the point in expecting him to head it away? There's no good there. You might as well expect something to break in the box, and you, as the partner centre half, should be ready to sweep up.
Okay, well, we can see how Harry Maguire responds to this. Will he start playing 10 yards deeper? You know what I mean? Because he knows that Lindelof might just crumple.
No, he didn't have to play deeper. He just had to start. He just had to get ready to start moving, rather than kind of being caught on his heels, essentially.
So make a run across the defensive line in the manner of a forward trying to break the offside trap, and then go if Lindelof loses the header.
Just close the gap a little bit with your other centre half. It's not that complicated, is it? From a long kick out, it wasn't some move where they had no time to work out where the two of them are going
to
stand.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, I think that if the ball keeps going through Lindelof like that, they're going to let in a lot of goals no matter where Harry Maguire stands. You know, I do feel that. You know what I mean? Like, Maguire, okay, so Schlupp, Lindelof misjudged the whole situation. Like, he misjudged the ball. He got underneath the ball, so he wasn't sort of coming to meet it. He got underneath it, and then he was like, oh, and then Schlupp had a run and a jump on him, and he got there first. Now, the problem, obviously, for Manchester United was, we've got Jordan Ayew coming through, and nobody's near him. Maguire starts chasing back after him. He's miles away. He's never going to catch him. And then De Gea.
Yeah. By the way, I'm probably misrepresenting Dunn here. He also said, obviously, Lindelof should have done better. And his big one was De Gea. Like, you had De Gea a couple of years ago. It was just your rock. And now this guy makes these mistakes.
Not too good. Like, not too good. Ayew hasn't scored in like 9 months or something. He's not a good finisher. Okay, this is an easy enough situation. But again, you've seen players miss those quite, you know.
Bit of time to think about it.
Pepe, not too dissimilar in the other game. And De Gea wasn't good. And De Gea obviously was terrible on the winning goal by Van Aanholt.
That was what I was thinking of. But so the first one, the mistake. What do you think the mistake was? Because it was one of those ones by Ayew where, in defence of James, of David De Gea, he might have felt that Ayew was going to curl it around him to the far post, as players often do. And instead he gave one of those little ones towards the near post. He kicked it almost directly straight, essentially at the near post, which always looks bad. And there's almost like this cliche about you don't get beaten at your near post. But was it not a clever finish, that first one?
It was a better finish, I suppose, than anyone was really expecting from Jordan Ayew at that point. You know, this is the reason why he hasn't scored in a long time. But, you know, again, it just sort of seemed like maybe he could have got it. But like, okay, they came back. Daniel James scored a great finish. And then they immediately conceded the goal. And you're just like...
bonkers.
Beyond belief. and then there was... It came up again afterwards. They also had a couple of injuries. Luke Shaw got injured and Anthony Martial. They both got injured. But the kind of injuries that were supposed to be avoided by the, remember all the sweating that was done in Australia and other places. That was the point, was to try to arm themselves against this type of thing. So, you know, a bit of bad luck, I suppose. Then the issue comes up again of the, a penalty's been missed and the player is being racially abused on Twitter. This is put to Solskjaer afterwards, as it was before the game as well. And he said the same thing in both cases, which was, you know, I can't believe that in 2019 this is still happening. You know, these people obviously have problems in their lives. I feel you feel sorry for them, if anything. You know, what could make you go on like that? He said something about how, you know, people hiding behind fake identities, you know, as Harry Maguire said. And you're thinking, well, I don't know about that. Like, you don't need to hide behind fake identities, like, in Britain. Is Boris Johnson hiding behind a fake identity? Like, he's the prime minister, and he's the guy who described Africans as pickaninnies, and talked about women in the cab looking like letterboxes. That's your prime minister, right? So don't expect your Twitter trolls to be doing any better than this guy. You know, that's the tone in Britain now. But you know, beyond that. It's a kind of a weird, I find this to be a weird story. I mean, Pogba has obviously put out some comments about this, a photo of Pogba holding his baby in front of a wall in his house where there's pictures of his father and of Martin Luther King Jr. And he says, my ancestors and my parents suffered for my generation to be free today. to work to take the bus to play football. Racist insults are ignorance and can only make me stronger and motivate me to fight for the next generation. He says, it took me a few days to comment on the racial abuse directed at me. When I hold my son against the heroes of my world, past and future come together. While seeing the amazing achievements of the past towards equality and freedom, I hope my son's generation will achieve so much more on the road to racial peace. I pray my son will not grow up in a world of us against them, but instead in a world where everyone can express and be him or herself without confrontation. I pray for those affected by racism to be strong. I ask God to forgive the perpetrators and give me the tolerance and understanding towards those poor souls. For all of us who wake up every day to fight our battles and serve him, may we be free, may we be healthy, may we be strong, may we never lose our faith. It's such an old trick to try to weaken somebody by attacking his or her skin color, gender, or belief system. It makes me laugh. So ridiculous it is. Together we will always be stronger. To all supporters, teammates, and friends who sent me so many beautiful messages from so many countries, my deepest merci. I read them all. So that's Pogba's message.
That's very well put. What do you find weird about the whole story?
Well, because, you know, it's... It's kind of when the thing happens... Immediately, you can see some journalists are doing word searches on Twitter to find, you know, player name plus racial epithet. Then, you know, screen grab, tweet, racist. You know what I mean? Like, I'm kind of like, is this fanning the story? Is this kind of fueling the story? It's then put to Solskjaer afterwards. Again, the question is, well, you know, can you, what is the correct approach here? Do you draw more attention to this thing? Do we then... You see what I'm getting at?
I mean, if it's happening, it's happening. I suppose it's the job of the people reporters to they're not making up the tweets, you know?
No. But they are bringing them to attention, which I think is what people want when they do this. Like, you know, is everybody who does this, it's one of the reasons why it's difficult. It has been difficult for social media companies to moderate. It's like the difficulty of, is everybody who does this like a sincere racist or are they trolls? You know what I mean? Is it like this has kind of become a thing now? It's like every time this happens, it's like a black player misses a penalty. Tammy Abraham, Paul Pogba, Marcus Rashford in the last few days. It's like, oh, get out there, you know, and do this. And like for a lot of these people, it's kind of a laugh to do this. You know what I mean? Like this is a difficult...
Well, I suppose the idea that you would racially abuse someone... The reason why people don't do that in the normal round of events is the idea of shame. You know, that you will be shamed for your action. You'll lose your job. Your friends will desert you. I mean, the whole idea behind... that's the social contract, effectively, that if you do something terrible, you'll be called out for it. Friends will desert you. You'll lose your job, whatever. Mm. Whereas with this, there is no shame because... if you're anonymous, as Solskjaer, as Manchester United,
if you're anonymous, I don't know if they are anonymous. You know, I don't know who's anonymous and who's not. Mm. You know, it can be difficult to tell. I haven't been.
I mean, if there's a name on a Twitter account, you know, like that means nothing. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You've decided to put a plausible sounding first name and surname together. It still doesn't mean that you're the.
Again, there are senior major politicians in the UK who are kind of, you know, throw a bit of racism about because it's quite popular, they find. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, but there's like, there is the cover, like there is some fig leaf of, you know, language, you know what I mean? Whereas, you know, a lot of the nakedly racist tweets, you know, it's just, you know, name plus racial, as you say, racial, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a particular internet commentator who's always being retweeted in recent times by Donald Trump, who's always going on about race war and, you know, the great replacement and talking about migrants as cockroaches. I don't think she's operating under an alias.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, yeah.
It doesn't seem like you need to hide behind anything. It doesn't seem like this shame thing that you're talking about really has much teeth. You know what I mean? Like, but again, as to this, like, I mean, I don't know. What is the actual scale of this? It can be difficult to know the true scale of it. It's like things aren't maybe necessarily quite as they appear to be. I don't know. It's a bizarre one. I mean, the social media companies are always talking about how difficult it is for them to police this. And it is, in one sense, you know, there's a lot of tweets. there's a lot of messages on Facebook. How do you go through them all? Can you do it algorithmically? Not really with any precision. Can you do it with people? Well, you need a lot of people. Well, okay, you've got plenty of money. Why don't you hire the people? Even then, though, the people can't necessarily tell if the, does this break the community guidelines? Does this not? There's a kind of a subjective element there. And then you've got the fact that the companies actually have a commercial imperative not to do this. Like, the last thing they want, I mean, Twitter, Facebook, and so on, is to have, you know, strict rules on what can and can't be said. The more rules there are about what can be said, the more, the less, the more of a threat it is to the to their sort of commercial status. You know what I mean? If like Twitter, for instance, were to bring in a bunch of rules, oh, you can't say this, you can't say that, then I think it'd be quite.
There are rules, though. Is that not the whole point? I mean, that actually is supposed to be against the guidelines.
Well, there aren't really, because a lot of it is sort of context dependent. Like, you know, is a certain thing might be a racial epithet when used in a certain way, but in another way might be a joke or it might be ironic. You know what I mean? Like, there's different things. You can't just make it. Or as far as I'm aware, there's no blanket rule that says if you type in a certain word, then that post is going to be silenced. You know, if they were to do this, a lot of people would be pleased, but then there'd be a big controversy over the rules. Well, you know, how do we, why this but not that? Why is this okay and this is not okay? There's all that, but then there's the fact that ultimately you get competing, you get competition. Who they say, we don't have these rules. If you want to have, you know, if you want to say whatever you want, come here. You know what I mean? That's
which would go down very well in that context. If people were thinking that they were being censored, essentially, go to the site, go to the source where you can say what you want.
So, yeah. One thing we can say is that's something Twitter doesn't really want.
Okay.
So underneath this whole thing, as they're kind of like, oh, this is difficult to police, you know, what can we do? Like, supposedly they've been speaking to Manchester United because it's, you know, United, like Solskjaer actually said in this thing, you know, we're not going to ask our players to come off social media. You know, like basically social media is a good thing. You know, we can't just let these dickheads ruin it. And of course, that's true also commercially for Manchester United. Like, one of the things that they love about Paul Pogba is his reach on social media. You know, it's like it's a huge, it's a kind of a part of their commercial strategy. They have their own commercial interests. The social media companies have their own commercial interests, which you can see the direction in which if they're dragging their heels on this, partly it's because it's a difficult problem to solve, and partly because it's a problem they really would rather they didn't have to solve.
Give us one final story for now.
Well, I think we'll have to have Mark Tighe's story from yesterday's Sunday Times. That was on the front page. And it was a really quite remarkable story. Let me read from it here. The FAI paid €300,000 to a friend of John Giles for coming up with the, quote, concept, close quote, of the John Giles Foundation, its fundraising walks, and a kit purchasing idea. The payments to Con Martin, a former League of Ireland player, were made in 2011 to 2016. At the same time as FAI staff salaries were being cut, the €5,000 a month payments to Martin were initially queried by FAI officials, but sources say John Delaney, then chief executive, insisted they had to continue. So apparently since 2016, Martin has been threatening to sue the FAI because they stopped these £5,000 a month payments. According to minutes from a November 2016 FAI board meeting, Martin said he had been told by Giles that the FAI sold the Walk of Dreams concept to UEFA, the European Governing Authority for Football, for €10 million. So
now UEFA say that they, as far as I know, that they don't have a record of that happening.
UEFA say no, and I'd be pretty amazed if one turned up. €10 million for the Walk of Dreams. Do you remember the Walk of Dreams?
Oh yeah, vaguely.
It was a sponsored walk.
Yeah.
What is high concept about that? You know what I mean? It's like it's not an original concept. It's not like what is worth money about the concept of a sponsored walk?
We have no answer. We have heard of sponsor. I mean, I've got a concept for a raffle, but I don't know if UEFA are going to give me €10 million for that.
And why would they pay? Why would they send 60 payments of €5,000 to this guy Con Martin?
in relation to this, it's extremely difficult to understand why so much money changed hands here. Giles, and I'm reading again from the article, Giles, an ex-Ireland player and manager and RTE football pundit, did not return calls last week. A friend of Giles said his position was the FAI payments to Martin had nothing to do with him. And then there's a bit about the John Giles Foundation. While it reported raising $360,000 in 2011, this was the Walk of Dreams year. This dropped to $60,000 in 2012 after many football clubs refused to get involved as the foundation was keeping half the money raised to distribute to other clubs and applicants. Blah, blah, blah. So apparently the Walk of Dreams thing the concept didn't really fly here, regardless of whether it got paid $10 million by UEFA. The foundation paid for Nadia Ford to fly over to Ireland and dance with John Delaney. This is at a dance competition. A lot of us will have seen the pictures with kind of a Dancing with the Stars type setup. John Delaney was there. So, pretty remarkable stuff as to why all this money changed hands and how the Walk of Dreams concept was ever thought to be worth 10 million euro. And again, I have to say...
Well, yeah, again, just to say the 10 million euro thing is something that Con Martin said he had been told, according to these minutes. But there's nobody saying that actually did end up happening, that it was sold to UEFA. UEFA are saying that they're looking into it and they can't see that it was sold to them for anything.
If UEFA had paid 10 million for the Walk of Dreams, I'd say there'd be quite a lot of member associations on the phone to UEFA right now going, I'm sorry for what? You know, so that was, again, another very interesting FAI story by Mark Tye.
That's on the front page. And then there's a full page inside with various other tidbits and stories around the FAI. There seemed to be an endless trove of these in the Sunday Times. So some interesting stuff coming out there.
Mr. Ken Early.
Every so often, I'm on the bus and I suddenly turn around and bite somebody.
John Hayes, I'm talking about, aren't you? John Hayes. Now, I always thought that was ridiculous.
He had won the victory over himself. He loved Brendan Rodgers. On
sight. That's where it comes from. On
sight. Thanks a lot, Pepe. How much do
you want to give a fuck? Fair to say anybody could have managed those guys?
No, of course not.
Let me show you right now before you give it up.
Well, it's fair to say the Newcastle supporters weren't exactly blown away by the appointment of Steve Bruce as their new manager in the summer. Two defeats in their first couple of games ramped up the pressure, but he may just have relieved some of that by going to White Hart Lane and beating Spurs yesterday. Mark Douglas is football editor of Chronicle Live. Mark, has he turned the fans around with this one, do you think?
I think it's definitely given people reason to think about maybe some of the opinions that they've had about Steve Bruce. I wouldn't say he's necessarily turned opinions around totally, because I think some of the question marks around his appointment that Newcastle fans raised were valid. They were justified. You have to think, would there have been too many other Premier League clubs who necessarily would have looked at him this summer if they had a vacancy? I'm not so sure. You know, his record is fairly kind of middling in terms of the Premier League. But I think what it did do is it did show that, you know, that Newcastle aren't as bad as a lot of people had said they were last weekend. And it also shows that it kind of reaffirms maybe the legitimacy of Steve Bruce being a Premier League manager, which I think was the biggest thing that he faced. A lot of people just didn't feel he is a Premier League manager. But I think he showed yesterday that the players are on board and he can set up a team to go and win at one of the big clubs.
The Chronicle this morning carries the most detailed description of a pre-match warm-up I've ever seen by one of your colleagues, Kieran Kelly. I don't think I've never seen anything like this. It's down to the minute, the times that they emerged onto the pitch, the sort of stuff they did, in terms of a tight perimeter had already been boxed off with cones, so Harley could get straight to it, dividing the starting lineup into two rows and leading them a range of stretches and exercises. I know that Newcastle is a massive football city and there's a thirst out there for information, but why exactly is it that this particular warm-up has attracted such interest and you're covering it in so much depth?
Well, I mean, you know, look, I think we're all in a kind of, we're in a kind of new era of sports journalism, aren't we, with everything that's happened with The Athletic and things like that. And I have told Kieran just to, you know, to look, if there's a different way of looking at things, then go for it. And we've talked about warm-ups all week because Paul Dummett gave what I felt was a fairly innocuous post-match interview after the Norwich game, in which he said he didn't feel the players were at it from the warm-up. And I mean, this is Newcastle United for you. It provoked, I think, one of the most furious debates about whether a management team are up to it or not, based off the back of that, because fans were sort of saying, well, this kind of shows that, you know, the meticulous planning of Rafa and his coaching team has kind of gone out the window, because the warm-ups look really lax and lackadaisical. And I think, really, Paul Dummett was kind of punished a little bit for being as honest as he was, because I think what he meant was that it just didn't feel right from the off at Carrow Road. Whereas what a lot of fans took that to mean was, here's Steve Bruce, he's kind of incompetent, his team are old school, they've kind of, the warm up is just a few players jogging around and not getting them up for the game. And I think Kieran's gone away and watched the warm up, watched the intensity, because I think he wanted to kind of, you know, look into, was there anything in this? And I have to say, you know, there was bits of the warm up where Steve Bruce was watching the cricket, and I kind of thought to myself, I bet he gets pilloried for that if the team lose. Whereas in reality, it really doesn't matter. And what we have at Newcastle at the moment, and I think it's a symptom of everything that's gone on, and it's not just this summer, it's not just, you know, everything, it's not just Steve Bruce even, it's a symptom of the fact that fans just don't trust this regime, means that everything is being picked over. So literally, he can give a press conference and people will micro-analyse the little words that are being said in there as proof that maybe he's not quite as cool under pressure as Rafa was. And things like the warm-up, things like the injury record, they're all kind of being analysed as sort of proof that, you know, the club isn't going in the right direction. And I think that's kind of damaging. And I hope what yesterday did was just maybe draw a line under that, because no manager in the world could withstand that criticism. And look, I'm not having a go at the fans, because I think a lot of the question marks that have been raised about what's gone on this summer are entirely justified. But we can't analyse every little thing that Steve Bruce says and every little thing that's been done. And I think maybe Kieran was doing that today to just sort of say, look, you know, we're getting asked, are you kind of analysing the things that are going on here? And I think he just went away, looked at it and said, hey, look, this is a proper Premier League club with proper Premier League staff who do know what they're doing on the warm-up.
Mark, you said Steve Bruce was watching the cricket. I mean, we were all impressed with Ben Stokes yesterday, but what was Brucey on his phone or something? How was he watching it?
No, somebody in the dugout. Somebody in the dugout had Sky Go on their iPad. I think it was one of the analysts.
Okay.
And Bruce was just kind of watching it. I don't think he could believe what was going on, but he's a huge cricket fan. But I think as a general point, you know, at that point in the afternoon, you know, Steve Bruce's work is kind of done there. And I think it was fair enough. I mean, I've been in Newcastle's press room where Arsene Wenger's come through kind of half an hour, 45 minutes before the game started, and he's watched the final scores come through with us in the press room, and sort of, you know, he's been, and you kind of think, look, managers don't really necessarily need to be imparting information into players at that point in the thing. And he was totally transfixed by it. We all were. But he was watching, he was watching the final. I don't think he kind of watched the actual final over, because that was kind of, I think it finished about 10 minutes before the match started. And I know, because I was watching the cricket while the match was about to start. And I was
4:16
thinking,
oh,
God,
PM,
this is going to be terrible. Was, yeah. I'm going to miss it. Yeah.
He said a few things. He seems to have, there's a few little feuds going on between Bruce and various members of the sort of media who cover Newcastle. I think, you know, Alex Bruce, his son, had a kind of a slightly hostile exchange on Twitter with Craig Hope, who works for the Daily Mail. He also covers the Ireland team, Craig, so he's over here a little bit. But Michael Chopra is the one who seems to have been leading the charge last week anyway. I just want to ask you about some of the things that were said here. I mean, Chopra had said some of the players don't know their jobs under Bruce. So you can imagine Bruce not liking this comment, which Chopra said it was told to him by, you know, players in the team. But I just want to ask you about one thing Bruce said back. I mean, he's saying this is lies. This is absolute lies. What does he know? It's absolute lies. It's lies. You all know why he is on the radio. You all know why he's on the radio. Newcastle legend, played 20 times for the club. Jesus, give me some sort of credence. If it's Alan Shearer, yes, come on, bring it on. So, okay, he's saying Chopra isn't like the, one of the most legendary of Newcastle legends, and fair enough. But how does he mean you all know why he's on the radio? I don't know why he's on the radio. I mean, is he a good talker? Well, what's Bruce getting at?
Yeah, I think what he means is that they put him on the radio because he's going to say something that's potentially going to be controversial, because he's been a very, very high profile critic of the regime over the summer. I think he did get a lot of traction for things he said about Mike Ashley, and he was extremely kind of critical of the appointment of Steve Bruce at the start. Now, there is a bit of history there, because I believe that Bruce sold Chopra at Sunderland as well. So there is a little bit of history there. I don't think he played much for Bruce there. But it seems to me like basically the Chopra has kind of become a voice of Newcastle for TalkSport, and they've had him on a few times. Now, I kind of took issue. And funnily enough, actually, Michael Chopra did send me a direct message on Twitter, because I was quite critical of what he said, because I was like, you know, what? So I made a few calls off the back of that. And the people that I spoke to around the Newcastle camp were saying, look, I do not understand where he's getting this from, because the players, sort of virtually to a man, are really kind of positive and really sort of defensive of what Steve Bruce is doing. While I think a lot of fans have been really critical of it, it's fair to say in the dressing room, the players have liked what Steve Bruce has done so far. And they kind of feel that, you know, OK, he doesn't work on shape in the same way that Rafa Benitez did, but no manager would. You know, they're all different. And so they felt, you know, and then they will kind of look at themselves, I think, this week, saying, well, who's been speaking to him? Who knows him? You know, I don't know him. And that was kind of the thing. So I actually said, when that was said, I thought it was a bit outrageous, really, for him to come on and say, look, players don't know what they're doing, because it certainly isn't what I was hearing. The players kind of did know what they were doing. It was more that it just didn't come off for whatever reason. I think the problem was Steve Bruce really bit hard at that one. We saw last season with Rafa, when Richard Keys and Andy Gray were having a bit of a go, he just kind of brushed it off a little bit. But Steve Bruce was absolutely furious. And he was actually furious as well at the media generally for picking up on the comments. But I kind of, you know, it has to be explained to him that this is the media ecosystem we live in these days. You know, somebody says something controversial, it gets picked up, and then he kind of answers it. And I think, you know, he felt that he was on the radio solely because he's been a very high profile critic. They needed somebody to hammer him, so they went to him. Mm. And, you know, I feel it's one of these many kind of dramas that we get in Newcastle, you know, that somebody's going to say something controversial and then it gets raked over for no reason. And it was a little bit like it was open season on Steve Bruce last week. And I don't think necessarily that came from much of the Northeast media. You know, I think you mentioned Craig Hope there, but, you know, some of the stuff that he'd written was just merely reflecting, you know, some of the mistakes that have been made so far. But, you know, it's just one of those things. Some people in the pack are more kind of maybe, you know, a little bit more critical than others. Some have stuck up for Steve Bruce. Some of the fans have said to us, oh, well, he's got mates in the media, so you're not criticising him as much as you did previous managers. And it's just that's Newcastle, because people are so passionate about the football club up here. That's how it is when they lose. It feels totally claustrophobic when they lose. And the tension and anxiety kind of rises when they go one or two games without winning. And it's like I said to you in the summer, it's about a kind of yearning for a football club that does things well and communicates and sort of they feel that it's going in the right direction. And I think, you know, it's kind of one of Newcastle's strengths, but it's also one of its weaknesses in some ways, that there's so much passion that it means that a defeat can sometimes take on a life of its own, and a good manager will sort of, you know, manage to dampen that a little bit. And I don't think, you know, necessarily Steve Bruce, I think he knows now what managing Newcastle is all about. He knew before, but bear in mind, he says he's a Newcastle fan, but he's been away from the city a long time. He has still friends here, but he's not been Newcastle manager. He's been Sunderland manager, but he's not been Newcastle manager. So he's getting a bit of a crash course in Newcastle United 2019 and what it's all about. Yeah. And I think he'll probably come out of it stronger.
Well, you know, maybe a victory can take on a life of its own. Like, this is the first good thing that's happened to Newcastle in probably about 4 months or or so. And you could hear like the joy of the Newcastle fans. Like, you know, you win a game like that against Tottenham, who were in the Champions League final last year. You know, this is huge. And I do wonder if, you know, obviously Bruce has felt really under siege and he said, yeah, that'll shut a few people up. Is he kind of consciously trying to cultivate that? You know, I mean, that's a, yeah, I saw there was some stories about how he'd been speaking to Alex Ferguson, who I think The Athletic had reported this, that Ferguson had told him, just get your head down and keep at it, which I suppose is gold.
Yeah, it's
sometimes it's all in the delivery of the advice. But, you know, that was a sort of a Ferguson technique to an extent. You know, these are all against us, you know, where it's just us and everyone wants us to fail. Is there a bit of that going on with Bruce? And how optimistic are you that he might be able to actually pull that off? This season could turn out to be Steve Bruce and the Newcastle players and maybe fans against you and all your colleagues in the press room.
Well, I think the funny thing is about the siege mentality, we've heard that from loads of Newcastle managers down the years, because I think they feel it's really not, the dynamic at Newcastle United is not players and fans against anybody else. The dynamic is that Mike Ashley has had 12 years at this football club and has made a mess of it, in my opinion, and needs to sell up. And there's a lot of things that have gone wrong off the field in the last few months. And that is what creates the dynamic. It's really not that the press are out to get Newcastle United. You know, Steve Bruce has a lot of friends in the Northeast media, it's fair to say, through just basically being a really decent guy. And you know, a lot of us know him from his time at Sunderland and really liked him there as well. And I think he knows that there are a lot of friendly faces in the Northeast media. But at the same time, when they lose 3-1 to Norwich and they lose in the manner they did, they're going to get criticised. But this siege mentality thing, you know, I think they do use it. I think that the team, the players in particular, have definitely used that over the last 3 years, because they've seen people writing them off as being a championship team. You know, these players aren't good enough. There's no goals. You know, they're all championship players masquerading as Premier League players. And they have 100% used that to their advantage. And I think, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that the words will have been said beforehand. Let's ram the criticism of the critics down their throats. But if you looked at our coverage of it last week, you know, we really didn't hammer the team, because we were actually getting hammered by some of the fans on social media for not being critical enough, if you will. And a lot of people saying, "Oh, well, you're saying give Steve Bruce time, but his record in the Premier League proves that he's not good enough." And I think that's the other point of the dynamic, is this social media thing. You know, you mentioned the fans in the stadium yesterday. They were behind the team from the first minute, from the warm-up. You know, there's a big difference between what's said on social media and what is being said in the ground. I've not heard. I was at the pre-season game at Preston, for example, his first on home soil. And there were fans in the away end chanting Steve Bruce's Black and White Army. And when I put that on Twitter, then I got a lot of fans saying to me, "Oh, that's disgusting. I can't believe they said that, you know, this, that, and the other." It's the modern way. You know, what is being said on social media sometimes gets interpreted as what the fans think. But actually, in the ground, the fans are prepared to give this man a chance, and they are going to get behind the team if they play as they did yesterday. The problem comes when they lose as they did at Norwich. And then I think, you know, some of the angrier messages on social media will then translate into the terraces. But it's just a maelstrom at Newcastle. It always is. What happened in the summer was, you know, crazy, and just it diminished everything. And the big worry that we had was they weren't going to be up to it in the Premier League. But I think yesterday proved beyond all doubt that they are. You know, they do have players who can compete at Premier League level, and now it's up to them. They've got two big games in the week, and if they can build on it, I think it really does steady the ship. The worry at Newcastle, and probably at a lot of other Premier League clubs as well, is if they lose to Watford on Saturday, you know, they're still in the bottom three. They've got Liverpool the week after, and it's like, oh, are we back to where we were? You know, are we back to where we were? But, you know, it was a massive win, and I think it buys everybody time, and it sort of shuts up a few of those questions about Bruce's legitimacy as a Premier League manager. You know, it's never dull at Newcastle. It sounds like a terrible cliche, but it's one of the reasons why we love covering the club, because, you know, even when it seems like it should be dull, because they are a Premier League team that haven't won anything for such a long time and they finished mid-table under Rafa twice, you know, it should be dull, but it never is. It's not a Stoke. It's not a Watford. It's not a Bournemouth. You know, there's always a story here, and that's why we love it.
Yeah, sounds like it could be a fun season ahead. All right, Mark, great stuff. Thank you.
No problem.
Off to bed I went.
My head was fried.
I didn't even know there was a damn card in the thing.
Fucking
I was
horror.
Devastated.
I'd been off the smokes a while.
Hard full.
Saw that. Back on there. I had a date organised for that night. A first date with someone. Cancelled that.
My head was gone.
Woke up the following morning and to my absolute amazement, I read this message on my phone.
Let me tell you, you're only getting this because you're a former player of mine, and I'm not too sure too many journalists would have got the third time lucky.
Hi Richie, sorry the equipment didn't work again, but it's no problem for me to do it again. Maybe see you in Ipswich one day for third time lucky. Best wishes, Mick. Best wishes, Mick.
I got the job on a Wednesday. I'd been a player up until that Wednesday. Took the training on Thursday. I picked the team on Friday and I took the game on Saturday. So I got the job on a Wednesday. I'd been a player up until that Wednesday. Took the training on Thursday. Picked the team on Friday and I took the game on Saturday. So it was a bit of a whirlwind.
Oh, God.
Well, I'm just looking down. I think all the red lights are still on. It looks like we've recorded this successfully. Mick, thank you so much for agreeing to do this so many times.
Richie, I sincerely hope so, because there's no fourth time lucky, let me tell you.
Saw a tweet there on Friday night saying Jack Grealish, hand clapping, you know, applause emoji. Jack Grealish ends his Premier League record run of playing in 20 successive defeats, says Sky Sports. His previous Premier League win came against West Ham in May 2015. 1,567 days ago. Jack Grealish retweeted that, saying, thank fuck. So congratulations to Jack Grealish, I guess, Ken.
Congratulations to Jack Grealish. I actually watched this game. It looked like fans at Villa Park are having a lot of fun this season. I'm okay, it was like a Friday night game, whatever, maybe, and it was their first win in 1,567 days, I guess, at this level. But yeah, it did. It's kind of interesting the way sometimes a team can get relegated amidst doom and then return a couple of years later would completely transform.
Gary Neville did not stop talking about how this is the best. This is always my favourite away ground. It's the best away ground. And I always thought, Villa Park?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't have any great images of Villa Park being this cauldron, but
It's a beautiful stadium. Yeah. I will say Villa Park is a very pretty stadium, but it for almost all of Gary Neville's career, with the exception of maybe
the
very
mid-90s,
first
early
couple
to mid-90s.
Of years.
Yeah.
It was like, it was a veil of tears.
Yeah, but maybe he was thinking back to those early days and there was a good rivalry then.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, they're back and it looked amazing, like absolutely rocking, as Jack Grealish himself said.
Everton, there was one moment in the second half when Theo Walcott was going to come on as a sub and he was standing there in with the haircut of a much younger man listening to Marco Silva give what looked like incredibly detailed instructions.
He's only 30.
I know.
Theo Walcott, he's been around an awful long time.
But he's listening to this incredibly detailed instructions from Marco Silva, who's literally like he's going almost insane, and Walcott's just like nodding obediently, and like yeah, I suppose. And it struck me, Walcott has spent more time doing this than anyone else who's ever lived. Walcott has stood there listening to managers intensely explaining how he's going to change the game as he comes on as a substitute more than any player that's ever been in football. And I thought, is this true? And actually I checked, and no. No, he has in fact only been brought on a sub third most times in Premier League history. 116 times on a substitute. The two leaders on 127 introductions as substitute. Can you name them?
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer?
Solskjaer, yeah.
Solskjaer, no. 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 127 sub appearances each for these two strikers. Two strikers.
Peter Crouch.
Correct.
Nice.
Crouch. Correct on one. Well, you've done your bit. Owen, can you guess the other one?
No.
You've spent a lot of time talking about this guy, let me tell you. He's
Olivier Giroud? No.
Not Olivier Giroud, no. He hasn't been around.
A lot of time talking about this guy.
Yeah. You've cheered him on, Owen, from time to time.
Oh, so he's an Irish player.
He is.
Robbie Keane?
No.
Hardly Robbie Keane.
Robbie Keane wouldn't have.
An Irish striker?
No one puts Robbie Keane on the bench 127 times.
Oh, Quinny.
Shane Long.
Shane Long.
Shane Long is the answer. Wow. Shane Long and Peter Crouch share the title of most Premier League substitute appearances. Shane Long might break this if he gets back into the Southampton squad at some point this season. But Walcott's there, and I think Walcott will end up top of this list. But just like to see him standing there and like, I don't know if he was listening or pretending to listen. It probably didn't make any difference. Because what happened when he came on was he ran to the back post. Kayan put across a great ball. And all he has to do is side foot this into the half of the goal that's unguarded and just balloons over the bar. And just shows Marco Silva, who laid out like the whole sort of Schlieffen plan on the bench. Like he'd spent so long explaining what he wanted Walker to do and he just balloons it over the bar at his big chance. He just thought, oh, Dio, 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 Dio.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks.
Thanks, Murph.
Thanks, Ken.
Ken
thanks
went
all.
Away into a Marco Silva.
He was just
not so wonderland
there to himself.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you during the week. And in the meantime, take care.
What's going on? Is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home. They never go home. They never go home, those boys.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.